Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Talk about lawyers today. You know, you probably don't need to consult a lawyer very often. So, you know, when you're in that kind of situation, when you do need one, how do you find the right person for you? And we're going to be talking about that today with Michael Riley. Mike is a third-generation Madison lawyer. He's a partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. And Mike can answer general legal questions. He has some tips for finding a lawyer. Maybe you have some questions about finding someone to represent you. I hope you'll join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And Mike Riley, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to see you again.
It's been a long, long time, and so I don't even want to know. I can't even think back to that time. So it's great to have you back, and fun to talk about legal issues. And there always seems to be more legal procedures that sometimes you can get along without a lawyer. Sometimes you need a lawyer. As you think about this, what are the circumstances that really require a lawyer?
Well, I should say from the outset that I'm a personal injury lawyer, so that's the focus of my practice is I help people who've been injured. But over the course of my career, I was worked for insurance companies. I've done a lot of kind of general practice where I did divorce and any number of other things. So I've had, you know, a taste of nearly everything. You know, if the issues are, for instance, you're in an accident and your car is damaged, do you usually need a lawyer for something like that? No. You know, you may need to do a little negotiating with the company. And if you want to call, you know, someone and get a little advice, that never hurts. And most lawyers are happy to talk to people and give them, you know, a little bit of advice, something on the phone without expecting a fee or expecting somebody to hire them. And so that's a good idea if you run into a situation where you're uncomfortable. And I think that in some ways, Larry, is maybe the best test is you if you get to a point where you say, I just don't feel good about this.
Yeah.
You know, you're trying to do something on your own, whether it has to do with real estate or, you know, an injury or whatever it might be. If you get to that point, you know, it's probably a good idea to get a lawyer. I just went through a situation where I had somebody call me from Kentucky referred by another lawyer. And they were asked by a friend, who may no longer be a friend, to put some money into a business that the friend was running. They'd given him some advice over the years, but now they actually gave him about $100,000. And they did that without any legal documentation, and now it's fallen apart.
Oh.
And, you know, now it's a mess because they don't have proper documentation. They don't have loan documents. They don't have a note, something that would require them to repay. And that's the kind of situation where you should think about what you have at stake. And if what's at stake is significant to you, and there are legal issues involved, then you really probably should at the least call a lawyer and get some advice and most likely think about hiring one.
What do you look for in a lawyer?
Well, you know, there are a lot of ways to find lawyers, and I guess maybe I hate to start with a negative, but I will. In my area, the law is probably the one where you see the most advertising. You see a little in criminal and things like that, but honestly, you don't see a lot of lawyers advertising for business work because businessmen sort of know how to find a lawyer, and that's part of what they do. But, you know, advertising tends to be directed at people who maybe don't have regular contact with lawyers. And advertising is just not a good gauge. I mean, there are firms that advertise that are one particular I think of that's a very fine firm. There are also a lot of firms that advertise that honestly are not the best at what they do and what I do specifically. And so I think if somebody's hurt, for instance, they get 10 or 15 letters from law firms seeking to represent them, and they get the accident reports, and right away the letter goes out, the slick brochure goes out. It's just not a good way to find a lawyer. I mean, it's something that we see happen, and I'm not saying I'd never hire someone that does that. I will say that it isn't the best way to do it. There are a number of different things you can do, and first of all, you know, if you do know a lawyer, even though he might not be a lawyer that handles things that you need handled, in my case, people will call me or talk to me and say, hey, I need this mic. And it's not something I do, but I know who's good, and I can tell them. And that's true of most lawyers. They have a pretty good idea of who's good, even outside their own field. And if they don't, they can call somebody that they know who does, and
yeah.
can give them advice. So I think that's always a great source if you happen to have that available to you. Sometimes if you work for a company, for instance, you know, you can go to the company lawyer and just say, hey, I need some help with something. And often they'll know lawyers or, again, can reach out to another lawyer and get you advice, which I think is helpful. There are several sources that people can utilize and should. And I'm assuming I'm terrible because I'm the world's worst about going online and doing things. But there are some great basic resources. Martindale Hubbell is the one nationally recognized organization that rates lawyers. They do it based on peer ratings. I get letters from periodically saying, here's 20 lawyers, rate these people for us. And you can be in, it goes A, B, C, or not rated. A is the best. It's always a V because V means highly recommended, and they don't mm-hmm. put you on at all if you're not highly recommended. But an A lawyer is the top. B is you know, usually good, and C is, again, is better than no recommendation at all. But you can go online, I'm sure, look at Martindale Hubbell. There are a lot. AV, I'm an AV lawyer. Our firm's an AV firm. We're not the only ones in town. There are a number mm-hmm. of really good lawyers who have an AV rating. And it's worth looking there because that at least is a decent starting point. You may not need an AV lawyer for everything you're doing, but that at least gets your foot in the door and gives you some sense. And if they have a rating, you know at least that other people have said, yes, these people are competent and they know what they're doing. So, you know, even if it's a B or a C, it's certainly better than somebody who has no rating at all. The other thing that's happened in the last 10 to 15 years is, you know, Madison Magazine does a Best Lawyers every year. Mm-hmm. And I'm in that for personal injury, and so there are several others. But it's a smaller number of lawyers than the A rating would be, and it gives you a sense, and they do it by the particular area of law you work in. So you have a sense if you want a divorce lawyer, you want a bankruptcy lawyer, you want a business lawyer, you can see who, at least Madison Magazine, rated highly. And again, they're doing that based on peer ratings from other lawyers in town. Milwaukee Magazine does a statewide super lawyers where, and it, you know, it's the first time they did it, we had a bunch of us, we had our pictures taken, and then we had our heads on the superhero costumes, which I thought was kind of funny. Some people in the firm thought that was a little over the line, but a lot of us thought it was funny. But what they do is essentially the same thing. They get ratings from other lawyers, and they do it on a statewide basis. And again, they'll show you the different areas of the law and give you names of people who were highly rated by their peers. So I think those are really good resources. If you, one thing you can do, the Wisconsin State Bar runs a lawyer information referral system, and you can call that or take a look at that's in the phone book, or just call State Bar of Wisconsin, and then you can, they will give you a referral. I don't think, and again, I'm not demeaning anybody who's on that system. I think a lot of lawyers steer a little bit clear of it because a lot of the things that come through are not necessarily things that are productive. And so I don't think there's quite as much screening for that. Let's put it that way. You know, I think that's not that it's not something that can be used. It certainly can. There, you know, if you're in the criminal area and you don't have the resources, you can go to the state public defenders. And in Madison, at least, the public defender's office lawyers are very capable people.
Mm-hmm.
I think the law school still runs a legal clinic, and for mm-hmm. civil matters, that's something that you should consider. You know, again, if you don't have money, there are a number of resources available.
Good, excellent. Well, we have every one of our phone lines filled, so let's take a call. Mike Ann in Madison has something for us. Ann, hi, thank you for calling. Ann, are you there? Oh, let's see. Ann, are you there? Well, we must have lost Ann.
Hello.
Ah, there you are. Ann, hi. Thanks for...
Hi. My question is, what kind of a lawyer would I call to have just a very basic, simple will written, and what would I expect to pay to have such a thing done?
Okay.
Lawyers who do that are called trusted estates lawyers, and they range from people. In our firm, we have several people who specialize in that, and that's, you know, a major part of their practice. You know, a lot of what I guess we used to think of as general practitioners. My dad was that. My mm-hmm. grandpa was that. Everybody mm-hmm. used to be that pretty much, but that's not the world we live in. But there are still a number of lawyers who run their own office or in smaller firms who may not concentrate their practice on that, but certainly would be perfectly capable of doing that. Again, I think you can look at the sources I told you about, but that's something that should be relatively simple because I don't do them. You know, I don't like to comment on exactly what it would take, but my sense is that should not be terribly expensive. You know, again, I don't do that work, but my thought would be it would certainly be less than $1,000. And if, you know, the initial lawyer thinks it's more than that, I'd call around and talk to several people and just get a sense of, you know, who might be able to do it. And that's something you should always do is ask a lawyer right up front, one, how much of this work do you do? And two, what's it going to cost me on an hourly basis? And can you give me an estimate of how many hours? And something like this, it should be fairly easy for a lawyer to give you a pretty precise quote on what that would cost you.
Yeah, I had a pretty, just in my own personal situation, I had to write a will a little while back. I think it was $500. And then I had to rework it a little bit. I think it was about $350 to rework the will a little bit. So, frankly, I thought that was a good deal.
And I would think that'd be right in the range, though, Larry, that, you know, to do a simple will, it's not a complicated thing. You know, you hear all these ads on TV and, you know, that we can do this for you and LegalZoom and all the rest of this. And I think there's just fraught with danger to do that. I think it's much better to go to an actual lawyer and get it done. And Larry's range seems very reasonable to me.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you for calling. Sarah in St. Mary's Point, Minnesota. Thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. I'm inquiring about how to go about finding an immigration lawyer, specifically for an adopted child and certifying her papers as she came across and is a United States citizen, but we need to document it. So we're thinking of an immigration lawyer in Minnesota. Do you have any suggestions?
Sure. I'd do a couple things. One, I would probably call the state bar in Minnesota, the Bar Association, which was the statewide lawyers organization. And I'm sure that they'll have a referral system where they would have, you know, immigration lawyers on that system. The other thing, and there are a fair number of immigration rights groups around, and I would look that up online and just see if there's, because I'm sure they must also maintain lists of lawyers who do that work.
So immigration rights, did you say?
Yeah, there are a lot of immigrant rights or immigration rights groups out there that, you know, are trying to speak up for people who are, you know, who are immigrants and who may need legal help. But also the state bar would almost certainly have a list of lawyers who do that work and could give you that list or give you several names from it.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you for calling, Sarah. Dan in Ashland has a question for us. Hi, Dan. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I've got a kind of a doozy for you here. I was injured in 2014 at work and underwent healing and everything. And I've got representation for that. But the thing is, they end of 14, my employer decided to fire me. And basically, it's a long story here. But I'm getting emotional here.
No,
but,
I'm sorry. Those things are horrible to go through.
So basically, went through healing, did that, did fairly well. So I basically got to end healing and started looking at, you know, when I got fired, I never got offered any kind of a notification for COVID insurance. And, looking at it, I called the, Department of Labor and they said, yeah, it's a violation. But in my process, I do have reputation, work miscomp right now. But he doesn't want to deal with that. And I've been trying to look for somebody just to represent me for the COBRA violation.
And you're in Ashland, Dan.
Yeah, it's a little different. So you're not concerned specifically with the fact that the employer let you go. You're really more interested in the COBRA?
Well, I'm going through the process of litigation with that right now.
Okay.
Okay. That's
a
difference.
Reputation.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. Well, COBRA is the right that you have to continue insurance when you leave an employer. You have a right to purchase continuation of your insurance, which is the COBRA rights. I've dealt with the issue, but we've always been able to deal with it informally, and it's not something that I've handled formally. Have you asked your lawyer about a recommendation for an employment lawyer?
No, I haven't really got anything. And the problem is I've learned so much about workman's comp now, my head's spinning, to be honest with you. But the problem is every time I call a lawyer, they're like, well, we're going to turn over to somebody, get back to you in a week, and a lot of people just blow me off.
Okay.
Yeah, that's frustrating. I mean, I would think your own lawyer who's handling your workers' comp should be able to find you somebody who could be helpful, hopefully, with that. I mean, I would ask him specifically if he would give you a name or names, and maybe he's already done that, and the problem's continuing. Again, you could go to the State Bar Lawyer Referral Service, and I probably is the next step here, is I'd call the State Bar of Wisconsin, ask them to get you into the Lawyer Referral and Information Service and see if they can find you somebody that has expertise in that specific area dealing with COBRA rights. The Department of Labor wasn't willing to help you with that? They couldn't step in?
No, I actually called the office, down Chicago, and they did say that it was a violation and there was a penalty and everything else, but they basically wouldn't represent me or fine them or do anything. It would basically become a civil suit.
Yeah, again, I'd go to Lawyer Referral and Information Service. You might also want to check with the State Department of Labor and check with them and see if they'd be willing to do something. But, you know, I know this is frustrating. I'm terribly sorry you're having that experience. It's miserable. But that's, I think, the best suggestion I can make.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with Michael Riley. Mike is a third-generation Madison lawyer, a partner in the Axley Law Firm, talking legal issues with him, finding the right lawyer, and other legal matters. I'm Larry Mueller. Marika Suval, our NR producer, here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn, her deals with all things political. She'll take a look at Jeff Sessions and also the president's first speech to Congress. That starts at 1 o'clock today on the IdeasNet. Looking at legal issues now and finding the right lawyer for you with Mike Riley of Axley Law Firm in Madison. Open lines will get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. David in Madison up next. Hi, David. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for your time and for your guest's time. I'm actually an attorney in Madison, and I have three quick points to supplement Mr. Riley's very good presentation. The first is that the Risser State Justice Building downtown Madison, just off the square, has a law library, and the librarians themselves are fabulous. They're attorneys. And while they can't give you legal advice, you can do a lot of calling on the phone to them, or if you're near in Madison, you can go down and listen to what they have to say as to how to look for things to find out whether you actually need an attorney perhaps or not. Secondly, very quickly, in most county courthouses, including in Madison on the lower level one of the courthouse, there are volunteer attorneys and sometimes even law students who have a clinic a day or two or half a day a week, usually on the kind of matters where people of lower income who can't afford or even moderate income can't afford an expensive attorney to deal with, like small claims, trying to find out about family stuff, divorce, child support, and visitation. It's worth at least a try to go down there first rather than plunk down $2,000 or $3,000. And finally, I would give a little more of a pep talk for the Lawyer Referral Information Service and a clarification. It's sponsored by the Wisconsin Bar Association. That's not a separate entity apart from the Bar Association. And anyone, what happens is attorneys throughout the state have the option of listing themselves on their areas of expertise. And everyone who's on that, if somebody calls the Bar Association for the Lawyer Referral Information Service at 800-362 9082, they can then get a name for an attorney whom they can call, and they get a half an hour or so a free consult. And that way they can find out if they need an attorney or how to keep looking for one or who in their area, the state practices in a particular area. I think those are supplemental presentations, maybe a little bit more for moderate or low-income people than Mr. Riley's been focusing on so far.
Yeah.
I think those are all great ideas, and I'm really glad you called. I appreciate it. I think that it is very important that people have access. And I think that lawyers make an effort and do some pro bono work, which just means work that you do for free. And the people who are staffing the clinics that David talked about are doing exactly that. But I think all those are great ideas. One thing came to mind from our last caller, and that's this. You know, communication with clients is critical for lawyers, and I think it's also very critical for clients. Lawyers take a lot for granted because it's what we do every day of our lives. You know, people who are dealing with the system for the first time, or at least dealing with the system in a particular area for the first time, don't know those things. They don't have that comfort level. And I think it's really important that your lawyer be responsive. I mean, you can't call your lawyer four times a day. That's not reasonable. And you can't expect the lawyer to get back to you within 15 or 20 minutes. But if the lawyers aren't getting back to you with information or not responding to your questions, that to me is kind of a red flag. And you should have a discussion with the lawyer about that and say, I'm concerned about this. I just don't feel like I'm in the loop. And if that doesn't get resolved, then maybe you don't have the right lawyer. And I think that's an important point.
Yeah. And David, thank you again. I appreciate your call very much. I want to give some others a chance to join in. And Jim in West Allis has something for us. Jim, hello.
Yes, thanks for the program.
Sure.
I'm interested in presenting some ideas to an attorney which affects companies and might cost them millions. One is a case of a large organization is not doing the service it's supposed to, and other companies are being harmed by it. Sort of a whistleblower thing. I don't know if that law applies to someone who's outside the company, the organization. And secondly, an idea for a company which might make it millions. Now, what I'm afraid of is presenting this to an attorney, having them steal the idea, and then I lose out on it. So do I have to see one lawyer to tell them that I'm going to see another lawyer so that I'm protected?
That's a good question, and it's an interesting situation. My wife years ago had this great idea for a food item, and it was something that would be prepared and packaged. And she sent it off to a company, and they kind of sent something back and said, well, you know, thanks for the idea, but no thanks. And then came out with the same product a few years later. Now, maybe it was a coincidence, but she remains convinced that, you know, she was done out of her idea. And it happens. I mean, there's no question that can happen. You know, I think, first of all, I mean, you can ask a company in advance for some kind of an agreement. Say, look, I have an idea. I'd like to present it, but I'd like to have an agreement that simply says that if, in fact, you decide to adopt this idea, that, you know, I'll be appropriately compensated. Obviously, it's no company's going to agree in advance to pay you 10%, 15%, 20%, whatever, or X number of dollars. But if you... And as you say, I wouldn't worry about going to a lawyer and having the lawyer take the idea. I think the chance of that happening is very small. The most important thing to me would be documentation, is that if you're going to send something to anyone, you know, you document that you're sending it. You make sure that you can show when you sent it, who you sent it to, and, you know, you lay out in some detail what it is you're sending them. Some companies simply won't look at ideas like that because they are concerned that then if they come up with something independently, they're going to get sued. So it's not an easy process. If you're going to talk to somebody, it's not really a patent or copyright kind of thing. It's a little different than that. So, and those lawyers, frankly, tend to be quite expensive.
Yeah.
But I think if you go to a lawyer who does some business work, a lawyer, particularly maybe a lawyer in a more general kind of practice, but who also does business work, he could probably give you some specific advice on that. And I wouldn't hesitate to call somebody up and just say, you know, again, if you go to the Lawyer Referral and Information Service, they would give you lawyers in a particular area of the law, and you could call one. I think David said you get half an hour. Take a half an hour, talk to him about it, and see if he can give you some good suggestions.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Marcia in Racine up next. Hi, Marcia. Marcia, are you there? Oh, looks like we lost Marcia. Let's go to Jerry in Milwaukee then. Jerry, hello.
Good morning. Thanks for allowing me to join in.
Sure.
Hopefully I can be brief with this. My stepdaughter had an automobile, probably 6-7 years old. She still owed money on it. It happened that it was parked in her driveway, and a next-door neighbor's tree in a storm fell on it, destroyed it. She had insurance coverage to where they paid off the vehicle, and it wasn't like she was underwater and owed like a lot of an extra amount or anything, but they paid the vehicle off, but now she has no car. And, of course, like many of us, she doesn't have a lot of money to go out and get something. I would think that'd be kind of equal value, so I suggested maybe the homeowner's insurance or the next-door neighbor would have some liability here. I was told that is not true. I feel that she wasn't made whole in the matter. I'm wondering if I'm just mistaken, and in order for her to possibly get something that might be of equal value to what she had, would she have to bring a suit against the neighbor?
Well, those are all good questions, and we see this problem constantly. You know, your first point that at least she wasn't underwater is fortunate. What happens is this was paid out of her insurance, so it would be her own collision, her own comprehensive coverage, not collision, other than the tree colliding with her car, but something like that's called comprehensive. The problem is that all they're obligated to do is to pay the fair market value of that car. For so many people, you know, they have a car, and especially if they've had it for a while, they like that car, they paid what they could pay, they were not in the market for a new car, had no interest in getting a newer or different car, and then this happens, and you're right, in a lot of ways, you're not made whole, because you're not going to get exactly what you had, which is a car you were familiar with, could trust, knew was reliable. Again, with your own company, the most you're going to get is whatever they're willing to, you know, the market value under the comprehensive coverage. And, of course, you've got a deductible, and many people are carrying $250 or $500 to keep their rates down. But when this happens, that means you're at least that far underwater in a sense that you're not going to get paid. You know, in terms of the neighbor, the question would be, I mean, if the storm knocked over the tree and there was no indication in advance that that tree was vulnerable, there probably isn't any basis to make a legal claim against the neighbor. You'd really have to show that this tree was teetering and the neighbor knew it, or that they'd been told by the city or someone that the tree really needed to be removed and had refused to do it. But just the fact that, you know, it was their tree on their property and it fell on your daughter's car would not make them liable.
Oh, there we go. Sorry for that information, Jeffrey. But, things happen sometimes.
Yeah, they used to say acts of God, but, you know, then God get blamed for a lot.
Let's go to Susie in Milwaukee. Susie, hello to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I have a custody question. I know a young man whose daughter is 2 years old, and he didn't even know he had a daughter until she was 2 years old. And the woman is divorced, the mother is divorced from the husband who claimed to be the child's father at the time. Going ahead with custody, would he need a specialty lawyer for this?
Yeah, there are lawyers. Divorce lawyers also handle custody matters, and you really should have a divorce lawyer for that. I don't know enough about that law anymore, as I probably did at one time, but I don't now to give you a lot of advice. I would think he would likely have they had now a paternity test to establish that he is, in fact, the father?
Privately, DNA has been done. I don't know if the court will accept it, but yes, the mother agreed to the DNA, and that's been done. But the man's name on the birth certificate doesn't know that he's not the father, and we don't know how to go forward.
Yeah. I mean, what I do is go to a lawyer who does divorce work. And I'd ask the lawyer, do you do custody work separate and apart from divorce work? I think there's a presumption of paternity in Wisconsin if you're in a marital relationship and there's a child during that time. My understanding is at least that there's a presumption, but that presumption can almost certainly be overcome if you demonstrate with a paternity test, with a blood test or DNA test, that, in fact, the person you know is the actual father. And I think then that the court, you just have to explore what parental rights he has. And my assumption is he would have some parental rights. But, you know, courts look at those situations. They always try to look at the best interest of the child. And as you say, that's a complicated situation. I guess maybe less so because the person who was married to the woman when the child was born is no longer married to her. But I think go to a good divorce lawyer and ask them to give you some advice.
Yeah.
Okay.
All
right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. We have John in Middleton up next. John, hello to you.
Yes, I'm wondering, is it absolutely necessary to have a lawyer to put together a will, or can one do this on one's own? It may be wise to get one, but is it legally necessary?
No, it's not legally necessary. I mean, there are certain legal things that have to be done to make a will valid. And I'm sure, I know there are will kits out there that you can get from different people. I would just, you know, what I would do is, if that's the way you want to go, and you're certain people are certainly entitled to do that. And for a real simple will, I don't think it's essential to have a lawyer. It just, it always concerns me that there are certain formalities that have to be followed. And if you don't, you know, you can end up with a will that's not legal. And a lot of it has to do with witnesses and who has to sign and whether they have to be together. There are a number of things. But most legal documents are pretty simple. You know, you write out what you want it to say, and as long as, you know, it meets the minimum standards, you're okay. In that case, a lot of what a lawyer is doing is telling you what you need in terms of, well, what should go in, what you don't need to put in. But again, if you want to get a kit or go online or do whatever, you can do that. I would make sure that I called a lawyer and just said, look, I'm doing this. Would you be willing to give me a few? I just want to ask a couple quick questions. I think most lawyers would certainly give you a few minutes and talk to you and just give you the basics to make sure you don't trip yourself up.
Yeah, I have Quicken Willmaker, and I was just wondering if I use that and then maybe ask, you know, paid a lawyer to look over what it produced, would that be a wise way to go?
Sure, I think that would be very sensible. You know, if you want to go that way, and there's, again, on a simple will, I don't think that's a big problem, but I would have somebody take a look just to make sure that you don't have some kind of fault or failure in the will.
Yeah. There were, I remember looking at the lawyer asking me a couple questions when I was doing the will, and I thought, oh, I hadn't thought of that. And so I was glad to have someone there to talk to.
Yeah, I think that's great advice, Larry. And again, I think you can do it yourself, but I think it's always wise to have somebody at least take a look.
Lori in Sturgeon Bay up next. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I was calling with a question about care for my elderly mother. She's begun to show signs of dementia. She's living in her own home with the help of her daughters who live nearby. We come in to help her with different needs. My question is, if the need arises where she would have to go into a memory care unit, is there anything that can be done ahead of time to possibly protect her assets that she had?
You know, I know there are some things that can be done. The government has taken steps over the last 10 or 15, 20 years, I think, as our generation, the boomer generation, my generation, starts to get closer and closer to that. And obviously, we're also seeing, certainly to me, there's been a real upsurge in these issues with dementia. And some of that may be an aging population. I think some of that is something else that we just haven't been able to get a handle on. But the bottom line is, this has become an increasing problem. The government wants to make sure that people exhaust their assets to the extent that's possible before they, you know, go into care. What I would do is this. I mean, there are lawyers that specialize in elder law, and I'd go either to Lawyer Referral or Information Service or call somebody and ask if they know somebody who specializes in elder law, because it's become a subspecialty. Those people have a good handle, especially, this is a question that obviously comes up a lot, and they'd have a much better handle on it. I don't have any specific advice that I can give you that I would want you to rely on, but mm-hmm. I think if you do get hold of somebody in that area, it would be helpful. I think there's also, there's certainly local agencies in almost every community that deal with questions dealing with the elderly and care and that kind of thing. So I'd pursue that. I think there's a state agency that deals with that. I think there are a number of different resources. Again, Lawyer Referral and Information Service, if you don't have another source for a lawyer doing that. But that's what I'd look at.
Mm-hmm. And it's probably something you want to do now while the mother has her faculties about about it because there may be things that she might need to sign and agree to.
No, that's absolutely right. And the other thing, and that's a great point, Larry Mead, I mean, you should look to it, having your mom sign some things for powers of attorney and different things that you may need, you know, if you want to pay a medical power of attorney. There are a number of different things that you can do that will help if, you know, particularly if the dementia becomes more pronounced and it would be difficult for her to make decisions. And that way you don't have to go to court and ask the court to give you, you know, something when you can have it signed while she's still competent to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I was just kind of curious. I was told that there's like a 7-year look back, so I didn't know if maybe it's really too late to do anything, or do you know?
There is a look back provision, and yeah, that's what it's important that doing it sooner rather than later is fine. Again, if this is something that's on the horizon, it may not help, but I still think you should talk to somebody who does elder law, or at least talk to somebody in one of these organizations that helps protect elders' rights to see what could be done. Because, I'm sorry, it's just not an area that I'm familiar enough to be of much help directly.
But that's good advice, though. Elder law, I hadn't thought about elder law until you brought it up, but that is a good subspecialty now.
It's becoming increasingly prominent, I think, because we have a generation that's having a lot more, certainly, difficulties with dementia and having to go into nursing homes than I recall in my grandparents' generation.
Yeah. Thanks again, Lori. Good luck to you. Bryce on Facebook has a question. He says, I'm a chair of a town chair, population of 348 people. We have a frac sand mine in our town. It's currently closed but could reopen. We have a non-metallic mining operating agreement. Our town attorney just retired. Any advice on how to look for a new attorney who practices municipal law and is experienced with issues like frac sand mining, but who is not from a firm that also represents sand mines?
Yeah. And, you know, there's some overlap there. I know there is in our firm. We have lawyers who represent municipalities. We also have, you know, several lawyers in our firm who work with, you know, frac sand operations. So we would not be a good choice. There are, though, a lot of firms out there who have lawyers who do municipal law. They're often, I mean, obviously this is a fairly small township, but, you know, there are certainly lawyers in the area that would do that. Again, I think if you go to any of the sources, well, Martindale Hubbell's different, but if you would go to Madison Magazine, Milwaukee Magazine, I'm sure they have those online. You know, they're super lawyers in Milwaukee Magazine and best lawyers in Madison. And they would break things down, again, by specialties. And municipal law is certainly a specialty. Mm-hmm. So you should be able to find someone there. Again, if that doesn't work, I don't know if your retiring lawyer has someone in mind. Otherwise, you know, again, you could go to Lawyer Referral and Information Service at the State Bar. But those are probably the best resources. To me, again, ideally, if somebody on the board or someone in the township knows a lawyer in a firm nearby, I'd certainly have them talk to that person and say, can you give me two or three names? And I probably should have said at the beginning, I would always get a couple or three names. I would go and meet with a lawyer. I always tell my clients when they come in to meet with me that the most important thing in the world is you've got to trust your lawyer, have some confidence in him. And the only way you do that is go and meet a lawyer and talk to him. And lawyers should do that for free.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for that question. Mike Riley, our guest today, Madison attorney, a partner in the Axley Law Firm. I'm Larry Mealer here on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mealer here with my guest attorney, Mike Riley, excuse me, of the Axley Law Firm of Madison. We're talking legal issues with him today and finding the right attorney for you. Join in. We have open line. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mealer Show. Let's turn to Paul in Wausau next. Paul, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello, thank you. My son is looking at purchasing a farm, and the owner is thinking about putting a conservation easement on the land. Can you tell me how that works or how that's enforced and how long does it last?
You know, I honestly, this is one of those areas where I would I don't have anything terribly useful to say. I know what a conservation easement is. It basically gets you a tax break, and you know that's why it's done. I mean, I don't see the concern I would have if it's a farm, and I don't know what use he's intending to make of it. I mean, if my son looked at buying a farm a while back or buying farmland, but really they were going to use it for hunting, and in that case, probably conservation easement would be absolutely fine. But if you were thinking of actually actively farming, I'd be very concerned about whether that would limit your ability to make use of the property. I guess I'm not sure why the current owner would be doing that if he's selling this to your son or intends to sell it to your son. It would seem much more logical to let your son make that decision and see what he was going to do. I don't know if the current owner is going to get some sort of short-term benefit from it. But the bottom line is that's something I'd go talk to somebody that does property law and make sure you get a good answer before I'd sign on to something like that. It could really limit the uses you can make of the property. And again, you know, your son knows what he wants to do with it, but I'd make sure what he wants is going to dovetail with having an easement. And again, it's hard for me to understand why the current owner would do that. But again, I don't know that area of the law. That's not what I do and really not what I've ever done. So I'd make sure you talk to a lawyer about that. Again, property law, somebody who does property law would be able to do that for you and pretty quickly, I would think.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Back to Marcia in Racine now. Marcia, hello.
Hi there. I got cut off before. My question was, after a 15-year hiatus from my former husband, I'm wondering how to go after Social Security in, say, 10, 12 years.
Okay. I think what you need, I would think the Social Security, have you called the Social Security office?
No, because I won't be doing it for another 10, 12 years.
Yeah. What I would do is the Social Security office in Madison is really helpful generally, which is not always true of Social Security. I get in 1 week, not too long ago, I got three letters all contradicting one another about what they were going to send me and why they were sending me that amount of money. But I think if you actually go to the office, they could give you a pretty good answer for that. You also, a divorce lawyer would probably know that. I don't, honestly. I don't know that there's anything you need to do now to protect those rights. I think those rights are likely dictated by federal law, unless in the course of the divorce you somehow signed an agreement to do something about that. Then I think it's just a matter of federal law, and I don't think the state court system would really be able to do anything about that absent an agreement that you entered into at the time of the divorce. So I'd call the Social Security office, and or there are lawyers who specialize in Social Security, again, and you could look one of those up on lawyer referral and information, or just talk to somebody and see if they can get you a referral to a lawyer like that. But again, the lawyer's not going to be able to do much right now, obviously, but it doesn't hurt to check on your rights just to see where you're going to be in 10 or 12 years.
Yeah, and you can, I think, get that free, really, from the Social Security, even if it's 10, 15 years down the road.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think that's a question they should be able to answer for you without you having to spend money to get the answer.
All right.
If I'm remembering correctly, I need to be unwed, correct?
I just don't know that, in all honesty. Again, that's why I'd talk to the Social. Those are the kinds of questions that I think come up fairly regularly, and I think they'll have an
very
answer ready
answer
at hand. And I'm sorry, I just don't. It's not an area I practice in.
But it's probably pretty good free advice you get from them.
Yeah, so. I mean, I think they're the best source in a lot of ways. If you don't like what they tell you, then you might want to go further. But I think they'll give you a good answer for that.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. Steve in Racine has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hello. I need advice on a neighbor's plumbed drain tile flooding my property.
So you're kind of breaking up there, Steve. So we have a neighbor apparently who did some drain tile work and wound up flooding his property.
Is that it, Steve? Is this
the
something?
Old drain tile that over the years they've allowed trees to grow on and plug the clay segment grate.
Okay, who's the they that allowed trees to grow on it?
A neighbor.
Yeah. Well, generally speaking, if a neighbor does something to alter the terrain, and again, this is a caveat, you're now dealing with a personal injury lawyer talking to you about property law and that kind of thing, and it's not generally what we do, but I know enough hopefully not enough to be dangerous, but enough to be somewhat helpful. You know, what I do, again, I talk to a property lawyer about that and find out whether there's a claim. Usually, to have a claim, you have to show that the neighbor did something or failed to do something that they should have done that created an artificial flow of water. Normally, they're not responsible for the fact that a large amount of rain falls on their property and just the normal terrain or topography causes that to flow onto your land. That normally isn't their responsibility. But what you're saying is there's something that's on their property that they haven't properly maintained, and that's causing the flow of water onto your property. And they might be responsible for that. I just, you know, again, you'd have to talk to a property lawyer because they'd have a better handle on exactly, you know, what liability or responsibility the neighbor may have to correct that.
But there is some possibility there.
Yeah, I think if it's, it sounds like it's not a natural condition, it's something that, you know, either they built or the people before them built, but they're not properly maintaining it. I just, you know, again, I can't say with certainty that they're going to have to do something, but if they've created this problem artificially or contributed to it, they might have responsibility, but a property lawyer would be able to give you a better answer.
There we go, Steve. Thank you for calling. Ziggy in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Ziggy.
Hi. My question is, we're renters, and we rent a home. It's on several acres, and it has four large willows, and where they're placed, they would, if they were to fall, they would definitely land in our parking area. And the willows have, every time there's a storm, they've dropped significant branches and sometimes whole entire limbs. But so far, they've always missed everything. But we are concerned because the way everything faces, or we're facing west, that wind hitting those trees, we are concerned that those trees are going to land on our cars if they were to fall. And we've told the landlord that the trees aren't in good shape and really need to go, but he doesn't really want to do anything about it. What kind of a recourse would we have if those trees do in fact fall?
Well, I think you've done the right thing. The one thing I'd make sure, you say you've told him, I'd make sure that's documented, that you've got, you know, something written in writing, a copy of a letter, emails, whatever. But I'd make sure you've got something that says, look, we've asked you to do something. We've told you this is a real risk. If that after that something happens, does he have liability? He might. You know, I can't tell you, yes, clearly he's going to be legally responsible. I would say that once he's been warned and told that this represents a hazard, you're much more likely to be in a position where you could go to him if it did happen and say, you're responsible for this and your insurance company should take care of it. You know, while we're on that topic, let me just make a clarify something. We were talking about the automobile insurance and the tree landing on the person with the person's car. It's funny, we had two trees on cars questions in one show. That's interesting. First of all, there's different kinds of coverage. There's coverage that's liability coverage, which means somebody has to be at fault. So in the case we talked about before where the tree fell, the question is, does their insurance, homeowners insurance, cover that? It might, because that's a question. Homeowners insurance generally covers liability, among other things, but it also says if you're responsible, you're negligent, and something happens to someone else because of your negligence, the liability coverage pays. There also are coverages that are not fault-based. So things like if you're on somebody's property and you're injured, they usually have medical payments coverage. It's often limited in terms of the amount, but they have medical payments coverage to pay your bills, and that's not a fault coverage. In the terms of the collision coverage on your car, comprehensive, because it would be comprehensive if a tree falls on you. But collision coverage and comprehensive coverage and medical payments under your auto policies are also not fault coverages. So you don't have to show anybody did anything wrong. You just go to your own company, and they have to pay based on the damage that's occurred. So there really are two fundamentally different kinds of insurance, and it's helpful, I think, to think about it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for calling, Ziggy. Appreciate it. Mike in Rice Lake, on to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I got a question. About 9 years ago, I was in a rough time in life, and I missed 95 days of child support. And we had an agreement with my attorney and myself, and the DA had an agreement to be a misdemeanor. But the judge didn't go along with it, and he gave me no jail time but 2 years probation, which there was no problems at all throughout the probation. And I'm just wondering now, I want to go back to court to try to get that off my record. Is that possible or a lost cause? Some of the research, some say I can, and Some say it can't, so I'm just kind of mixed on what to do there.
Sure. You know, that one, let me just say this. Why don't you give me a call at the office? I'll talk to one of my people at the office. That's something I might be able to get you a real easy answer to. So our number is 608-257-5661. I can't do that on everything by any means, but at this one, we might be able to help with. My immediate reaction is it may well be a lost cause, which is unfortunate. One of the things that Governor Walker has done that I have difficulty with is that he just isn't granting any kind of pardons or anything, and I see no reason for that at all. It's something that clearly in something like this, it's unfortunate because you ran into a difficult judge. Judges have broad discretion. My guess is the vast majority of judges in the state, you know, given a recommendation from the DA and your lawyer would have said, okay, fine, you know, we'll do a misdemeanor. And you ran into somebody who was obviously a law and order guy who just felt that particular problem is a severe problem in society, and it can be a very significant problem. But in your case, that seems draconian. It seems unnecessarily harsh. Again, give me a call, and I'll talk to one of our people. My sense is I just think the chances of getting that done, unfortunately, are very small.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have Michael up from Middleton next. Michael, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I have another property question, but maybe this one's easier. My wife and I, we've been married a couple of years, and my wife owns the majority of the house. Her brother owns a portion, and we want to buy him out. And I did a little bit of research, and I guess I'm wondering, can we just do a quit claim deed, and my wife and my brother will negotiate the price and get it recorded? I mean, is that involved?
Yeah, that should be pretty simple. Again, I think I'd just get that done. I'd probably, if you can, just call a lawyer and ask who does that work, property lawyer, and ask him.
I think it'd be pretty simple, though.
It's very simple.
Mike Riley, our guest today, partner in the Axley Law Firm of Madison. He'll be with us up till 12:30 today. Take a look at the news, then we'll be back with Mike. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. We're talking about legal issues on the show today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mike Riley, third-generation Madison lawyer, a partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. Legal questions, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And a couple of emails. Kathleen asks, says, I live in a subsidized apartment complex where some tenants are behaving badly, but their leases keep getting renewed. Management seems to be protecting them. I was bullied by them and subsequently hurt. Do I have a case? What kind of lawyer do I contact? I'm not sure. The question, is it about the being bullied and injured, or is it?
I mean, if you're injured, and this happens in a lot of circumstances where you're in a facility and you get injured, I mean, bars are the most common place where that happens, where, you know, there's somebody's misbehaving, the management's aware of it, and they don't do anything about it, and then that person injures you, you may have a claim. I mean, we've handled those claims and recovered money for people over the years. It depends a lot on the circumstances. In your case, you're talking about, you know, where you're living, and since it's subsidized, I don't know who the other tenants are and how much control the landlord has, because there are tenants' rights as well. But, you know, certainly if you warn the landlord once or more than once, and it sounds like this was repeatedly, that you're having a problem with these people and specifically that they're threatening you in some way and then they in fact injure you, you know, you certainly might have a claim against the landlord. And it would be worth talking to a lawyer. That would be a personal injury lawyer, my area of the law. If you're talking about, you know, again, tenants' rights, there are a lot of lawyers that do tenants' rights, and you could contact a tenants' rights lawyer, again, through the lawyer referral and information system, or perhaps through, you know, your local bar association. But if you get a name, they could probably tell you what your rights are in terms of the landlord removing people who pose a threat or who are behaving in a way that infringes on your rights to enjoy your property. You know, we talk a lot about rights in this society, and people are always focused on their right to do this, that, or the other thing. And people sometimes forget that rights interact and rub up against another all the time. So while these people, you know, certainly have some rights based on their lease, you have a right to the quiet enjoyment of your property. And if the landlord is not taking steps to ensure that you can exercise that right, then, you know, there may be something you could do with that, too. But again, that would probably be a tenant's rights lawyer.
Richard in Broadhead up next. Hi, Richard. No, Richard. Let's go to Rob in Eau Claire. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, back in 2005, I've got went and got convicted of alcohol contact of 0.08 of less than 1.0, and the judge dropped the driving while intoxicated. And my question to do is for employment applications. I can't find anything on my record anymore of stating that, but I thought that that was on my record for 55 years. So I'm kind of confused in how to answer those questions on employment applications.
Well, first question is, and again, you know, the caveat is, while we have employment lawyers, I'm not one of them. But I will say this. The question is usually, are they asking whether you've been arrested or asking whether you've been convicted, and are they saying of a crime? So it really depends kind of on how it's framed. I mean, there are limitations about what they can ask. It usually, my understanding is it's generally limited to convictions. But again, I'd talk to an employment lawyer before I relied on that entirely, because again, it's not my bailiwick. But have you gone on CCAP and you can't see it on CCAP is the circuit court access program, and you can go on your computer and basically go to the county where you're involved in, and the CCAP should tell, I mean, it tells you a lot of things. There's a lot of information on CCAP, but it, yeah, among other things, it should show if you've got a conviction that's still of record.
Yeah, because it was confusing, because the first one I understand is civil, and then the judge dropped the driving while intoxicated, and I contacted my lawyer. I did get a lawyer at the time when I was going through it.
Sure.
And she really couldn't explain it to me either, and this is, like I said, it's been 12 years, and I still can't get a very good answer. I don't know. I want to make the right decisions, but I don't know. What's going on?
If it's not on that CCAP,
yeah, I don't think if it's on CCAP. I mean, that's what an employer is going to do generally. Is they're going to go. I mean, they probably hire a company to do it, but I mean, generally, what they're doing is accessing CCAP. So if that information is not on there, I don't know how they would get it. I think also, I don't think you weren't convicted of a crime, and that's normally the question they have to ask, is they have to say, were you convicted of a crime? And you weren't. It was a civil matter, so that's not even a misdemeanor. I mean, that's just not a crime at all. It's like a speeding ticket, in effect. If that's the way, if it was treated as a civil matter, then it's no different than a traffic ticket, and unless they're asking about traffic tickets, I don't know why you'd have to disclose that. But again, you know, I'm always a little reluctant to be given advice in a field I don't practice in. But to me, that's what I can tell you is, if it's not on CCAP, it's hard for me to see how someone would find it. And two, if it's a civil matter, not a criminal conviction, then if they're asking about crimes, then the answer is you haven't been convicted. If they're asking about arrests, that's a different matter.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Email us, by the way, at ideas. At WPR.org. I've been saying talk at WPR.org, and I guess we're still using it for a day or two, but it's really ideas at WPR.org if you want to send us an email. Ideas at WPR.org. Call us at 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. And let's go to Ryan in Appleton next. Ryan, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. So I recently just got out of a lease with a landlord, and throughout the entire leasing of the apartment, they were kind of upcharging us a lot of things, and they ended up increasing our prices of health.
Oh, we lost Ryan. So here we have a landlord that may have overcharged for damages when they moved out. That's landlord-tenant.
It is, and you know, the best answer there usually is, I mean, they have to live up to the lease. Whatever the lease provided, they have to comply with that. There are a lot of good landlords out there who do the right things. There are some landlords who are always going to try to hold back your security deposit or a piece of your security deposit. One, if you really needed a lawyer, you could go to, you know, a tenant's rights organization, and certainly that you wouldn't hurt to talk to them. The other thing is that's an ideal kind of thing to deal with through small claims, because small claims courts, they have them in every county. They're very simple. You go out, you go in, you fill out the forms. They generally will take care of serving the person, and you just state in very simple terms what's happened and why you think that they've committed a violation and why you think you're entitled to money. And ultimately, you can represent yourself in small claims. It's not difficult to do. Among other things, landlords may represent themselves. Corporations can't. And usually when a corporation has to go out and hire a lawyer, it gets a lot more expensive than settling the case. And that doesn't mean you should file if you don't have a legitimate claim. But it does mean once they get an actual lawsuit, a lot of times companies, including insurance companies, just don't believe you're going to really do something. They think at the end of the day, you'll take what they offer and that's it. And if, you know, it's something that's worth hiring a lawyer for, that's great. But within small claims, once they get served, then they're going to end up having to hire a lawyer to do that unless they have in-house counsel. And you know, that can get expensive. So you have some real leverage there. Small claims is now up to $10,000 for most things, up to $5,000 if you're suing an insurance company. So there's a fair amount of money, a substantial amount that can be at stake in small claims court.
Barbara in Middleton, I believe. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I'm planning on purchasing a home in southwestern Wisconsin. And the title company told me there's no easements on the property, yet the neighbors are using the driveway that's on this property I plan to purchase. And how am I supposed to protect myself? Get an easement before closing or what?
Well, what you need to do, again, you probably should talk to, you know, a property, or you should talk to somebody who does, you know, closings, who does real estate is really probably the best term for that, not so much property. I'm always concerned, you know, what title companies know is what's of record. So what they would know is if there's filed with the Register of Deeds, and there was a question previously about a quitclaim deed. If you're going to do that, make sure it gets filed with the Register of Deeds, because mm-hmm. that's critical. You have to, if you're going to do it yourself, file it there. They may be able to give you some advice or may not, but it has to be filed. In this case, what the property company knows, what the title company knows, is what's on record at the Register of Deeds office. But the problem you could have is there's something called an easement by prescription, which simply means people have been doing this for a long time, so they've now acquired a right, you know, to do it, even though it isn't filed. I don't know that that's the case here at all. It may not be. But what you'd need to know is how long have they been doing this? I mean, how long has this been going on?
It's been 50 years.
Oh, 50 years?
They've been using this. They had an agreement, just an oral agreement, that they would clear the snow and whatever as long as they could use it. But they have the possibility of putting in their own driveway, but I don't know.
So well, have you talked to them or have you spoken
themselves.
To them at all about whether they assume they're going to get to continue to use this?
Well, it's the only way they have right now to get into their property.
Yeah.
So I was planning on having a lawyer draft something where it says I'm held harmless in case of injury on their part. Upkeep on the driveway is shared. And then also that if ownership in either my property or their property happens, that this plan or easement is renegotiated at that time.
No. I think it's a good idea to talk to a lawyer about it, because if it's I wouldn't worry much about liability. I mean, I get questions on that all the time from people, and usually, mm-hmm. frankly, those concerns are overblown, and you'd have insurance anyway, which would almost certainly cover it. But again, it's hard for me to imagine what kind of liability you'd have if they're exercising an easement that they've been using for years and years. I don't think that's a worry. But I think you should talk to somebody and get some advice on, one, whether there really is, do they really have an easement by prescription? And they may, because it sounds like they've been doing it for a long time. But there are all sorts of different rules that apply to those things, both in terms of time and the nature of use and whether the use is exclusive. And so those are the kinds of things that a property lawyer could answer for you, or a real estate lawyer could probably answer.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Leanne in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Leanne.
Hi, thank you so much for the show.
Sure.
I will try to be really brief on this. So basically, we have a we live in a condo. So in the building has its own condo association as well as a separate management company managing the building. So about 2 years ago, we first discovered that there was some kind of a leaking thing from the ceiling.
Yeah.
And it's been 2 years and we still haven't found where the leakage was. So we informed the condo association and informed the management company. And during this past 2 years, there was one change of hand. So we now have a new management company, but it just seems like everybody is slowly doing something, but so far we still haven't found the leak, and it continues to leak. And for 2 years, we've had our ceiling completely opened up and pans everywhere trying to collect this water. So I'm wondering at what point, you know, do we have to say, you know, enough is enough? Let's just get the bottom of this, and maybe, you know, a lawyer is something that we have to investigate or, you know, seek opinions about. It's been going on for 2 years.
You have the patience of a saint.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine enduring that for 2 years. I mean, certainly the condo association, you know, the condo association is responsible essentially for anything outside your four walls. I mean, the interior of your house is usually your responsibility, but this is clearly coming from outside that. I mean,
yeah,
it's coming down through your ceiling from somewhere else. I assume this is, you're on one level?
Yes, we're on the first level, and this is a four-floor
okay,
condo building. So,
so I mean,
there are some other units involved.
Okay. There's got to be.
So is there, are other people are having the same problem on other floors or on your floor? Or do you know?
Well, it's sounded like people have random leakages, but at various floors. They're not directly above us. They had all sorts of theories about where this water may have come from, you know, when rains at certain directions, if the wind is coming from, it's just, you know, they've slowly eliminated one theory at a time, but you know, this leakage only happens when it rains.
Okay,
so half of the year,
it's not pipe. It's
that.
Okay. It's obviously not
right.
Pipes. It's not something.
Correct.
Well, that means it's coming from the exterior, and that's clearly the responsibility of the association. You know, the management company is just that. I mean, they're managing for the association, so it's the association's obligation to you to fix this. And you know, if you can't get satisfaction from either the management company or the association, I would go to a lawyer, because clearly any damage that's being done to the interior of your house, they're responsible for not having fixed this. And the fact that you've been living in the situation you have been for 2 years is ridiculous. And ultimately, I think that is negligence. And I think you would have a cause of action. You could bring a claim if you wanted to. I mean, obviously what you want is just to fix this. And that's, you know, a lawyer here, it's not so much a matter coming in, a lawyer coming in and filing a lawsuit instantly. It's more a matter of a lawyer going to these people and making it clear that if they don't fix this within a reasonable time frame, that then there will be a lawsuit brought. Because clearly they've got a problem with their roof, you know, maybe with the eaves or with the siding. But it's almost certainly has to be one of those three things, because it happens when it rains. And that just shouldn't be that hard. Have they tried to replace the roof or replace the siding or do any of that?
Well, they're trying to identify where the water is coming from. And so far, you know, because other units, they have to either get into other units to look at the trail of water or, you know, and they have to gain access to those units. And it's been a very, very slow
frustrating holdup.
Yeah, I'd say inexcusably slow. Now, that's something where I'd go to a lawyer and just talk to him, see if you can get some advice. And if necessary, I mean, it's hard to say. I don't know that I'd bring a small claims action just because it may well be more than $10,000. But again, that's an avenue you could take. We just say, fine, I'll sue him for the within the $10,000 limit. But I'd make it clear to them that you are going to consult a lawyer and that the fact that this continues to be a problem is unacceptable, and that if you do go to get a lawyer, then you're going to have to bring a claim against them, and you're going to expect the insurance company to take care of it. Once you bring a claim or do that, the insurance company is going to get involved because they have insurance. They have to.
Yeah.
And at that point, the insurance company is going to force some kind of solution. They're not going to let this just go on.
Yeah, there we go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Jeff in Middleton has a question for us. Jeff, hello.
Hey, gentlemen. Hi, counselor. My question is that I've got a mortgage and a deed up here, and thinking about committing with another individual, and that would involve putting him on the deed. But I think I've since then found out that he's got an addiction. And my concern is if I were to put him on the deed, which is never a great idea to begin with, I understand that. But in lieu of that, is that person able to assign his interest in a deed and a property to some in a real property to somebody else or not?
Without your permission, yeah.
Like, I mean, it depends a little bit on what kind of a deed you're talking about. You know, you can have purchased something as tenants in common. You can purchase it, you know, in a way that you have joint ownership or that you have owner and tenants in common isn't a good way to put it. You could purchase it in a way that you either both jointly own the whole property, or you could purchase it in a way where he owns half, essentially, and you own half, an undivided one-half interest, but still a half interest. That he almost certainly could sell or assign. He probably could assign his interest. Again, it's, you know, I'm not somebody who's a property lawyer. I don't do that sort of thing. But I agree. It's not a good idea at all if you feel that might be a concern. And I think generally just owning property jointly like that is fraught with pitfalls. And
yeah.
I think before I'd do it, I'd certainly talk to a lawyer and see what the worst could be, because people with problems like that, the worst it occurs all too often, unfortunately.
Oh. My concern was that I'm worried that he would assign his interest and create money for himself to do whatever problems he's wants to continue creating for himself.
Yeah, and I think that certainly a very real possibility. I mean, obviously, it's always going to be subject to the mortgage and a lot of other things, but it's just having someone with those sorts of rights who you don't really have a good deal of confidence in is not a great idea.
Thank you very much for calling, Jeff. Appreciate it. Diana in Elk Mound, your turn. Hi, Diana.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a general question, I believe it is. I'm just wondering if my husband would be available to get a partial disability. He's completely deaf in one ear and 40% to 60% deaf in the other ear.
Sure. Are you talking about a disability under an insurance policy or like SSDI, Social Security disability?
The SSDI, Social Security.
Yeah, I'd call. There are people in town here who do that, and I'm sure there's people, and probably you guys are closer to Eau Claire or La Crosse. I should know. I've been by Elk Mm-hmm. Mound more than once. But I'd talk to a lawyer in one of the cities that's near you. There should be people. And again, you can go to the Lawyer Referral and Information Service, which I'm sure you can do online, too, Mm-hmm. with the state bar. And get a lawyer who does Social Security. There are not a lot of people who specialize in that work, but there are in Madison, we have lawyers who do that here, and who are good at it, and I think do a good job. It's an odd system. They turn down almost everything the first time around. On appeal, you often get disability granted. It usually depends on how much it impacts your ability to work. It's not so much your day-to-day functioning. It's really your ability to work that they're usually looking at. So, but again, it's really isn't my bailiwick, and I wouldn't. I would call a lawyer who does that stuff and just get a sense, because they do enough of it, so they should be able to give you a pretty good sense immediately whether or not that might qualify for SSDI.
All right, there we go. And, boy, we covered a lot of areas here, Mike, and we're out of time. I hope you can come back and do this again with us.
I'd love to. It's always a pleasure, and, you know, the callers always have some really great questions, so it's fun.
Mike Riley, third generation Madison lawyer. He is the partner, a partner in the Axley Law Firm. Well, covered a lot of things. We'll do it again. Tomorrow we'll talk about prostate cancer and take a look at the history of vaccines. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.